Hey everyone, I'm Thanos Davelis, and welcome back to our podcast, The Greek Current, for your daily roundup, where we highlight the top stories of the day every afternoon with analysis from guest experts, policymakers, journalists, and HALC staff. Professor Henri Barkey joins our podcast today to walk us through his latest piece, titled How Erdogan Muscled Turkey to the Center of the World Stage, and point out how Erdogan has refashioned Turkey as a revisionist power, openly challenging not just its neighbors, but also fellow NATO allies like France and the United States. Henri Barkey is the Cohen Professor of International Relations at Lehigh University and an Adjunct Senior Fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Professor Barkey, it's great to have you back on The Greek Current.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned in our introduction, your piece looks at how Turkey has refashioned itself as a revisionist power challenging neighbors and allies. The chief engineer of this shift is President Erdogan. What are the overriding features of this shift or transformation?
Well, Erdogan at the moment wants to do two things. He's using his foreign policy and this revisionist move to kind of propel himself and Turkey to the center stage of the world. He's no longer satisfied with Turkey just being a regular NATO ally. He wants, and he always wanted, I think, to make Turkey what Davutoğlu, his former foreign minister and prime minister, used to say, a central power. And by that, he meant one of the big powers in the world, right? One of the consequential powers, the ones that could make decisions like the UN Security Council permanent members, the five. And he always says that the world is greater than five, meaning that there are more than five determinant countries in the world. And he's always thought that Turkey should be one of them. Erdogan is a calculating person. I mean, he seems to be acting impulsively now, but in fact, this impulsiveness is the result of many years of slow build-up of Turkey, both economically and militarily. And the Turkish military is in much better shape. They're going to launch, for example, in the near future, their own homemade small aircraft carrier. You've heard of their success with drones in Libya and Azerbaijan, and also in Turkey, in Syria and Iraq. So there is a great deal of self-confidence now in Turkey, and especially in Erdogan. We've seen him push the envelope in Libya, in Syria, in the Eastern Med especially, and he's challenging. But the purpose of that is to satisfy, if you want, his own ego. He really thinks that Turkey should be the inheritor of a big civilization, big empire. And also, he sees himself very much as the most important country in the Muslim world. If you look at Turkey in comparison to all the other Muslim countries, it's the one that's in that best shape. But there is another aspect to his push, and that is that he's using this foreign policy, adventurism or revisionism, to bolster his domestic support.
Professor, can you elaborate on that domestic angle for us?
Domestically, he has a problem. In fact, I would argue he has two problems. One is the fact that the Turkish economy is suffering. It's suffering paradoxically because it's been mismanaged, and it's been mismanaged by Erdogan, who has insisted that interest rates should be kept low despite high inflation, and that has caused the Turkish lira to decline considerably, and that decline is not about to stop. So there is a great deal of unhappiness in Turkey with the economic situation. COVID, of course, hasn't helped. Let's face it, COVID hasn't helped anybody except the Chinese. So we can say that, you know, a combination of COVID, poor economic management has damaged his reputation at home. And the associated problem with this is Erdogan has been in power now for, 17 years? And when you've been in power this long, you own the economy, you own everything. He cannot blame his predecessors for failings. As far as the Turkish people are concerned, if they don't like the situation, there's only one person who's responsible for that, and that's Erdogan. By having this bombastic foreign policy, he essentially is galvanizing the nationalist feelings in Turkey and using them to shield himself from criticism. And in this revisionism and in this bombastic foreign policy, there's also an aspect where he blames other countries and other organizations, other groups for trying to do Turkey in, right? And he keeps saying that Turkey is under siege by a whole series of countries. And this has been also going on for some time.
One of the things that you cover in your piece is how this shift in this more aggressive foreign policy took place over Erdogan's 18-year rule. What was Turkey's foreign policy like in the early years of Erdogan, for example? And what changed about a decade ago, which is when you point to as the moment that real changes to the foreign policy begin?
So the initial stages of Turkish foreign policy under Erdogan was very different. At least it gave the perception that Turkey was interested in much better relations with everybody, from Europe to its neighborhood. Davutoğlu had this zero problems with the neighbors policy, where Turkey genuinely tried and actually was quite successful in some ways to project a policy that at home and abroad was quite progressive. At home, it was democratization. It was to open up the Turkish political system, which until then had been very much under the tutelage of the military. Of course, he was doing that in large measure because he also wanted to contain the military. By opening up to Europe, by democratizing, by bringing human rights issues to the fore, he was kind of pushing the military out. And in terms of the region, by showing that, especially in the Muslim world, that you can be a Muslim country and also a democracy, that gave Turkey a great deal of soft power. So it was a combination of democratization at home, the projection of soft power. That was the first part of his foreign policy. Things started to change in 2007. I picked 2010 only because it's really the consolidation of some of the changes. And 2007 is when the Turkish military gets defeated by Erdogan, because the Turkish military overstepped and tried to prevent Abdullah Gül, Erdogan's then ally, now opponent, from becoming president of Turkey. And the only reason they didn't want Abdullah Gül to be president, not because they didn't like him, actually, they had good relationship with him, is because Abdullah Gül's wife wears a headscarf. And the notion of having a woman with a headscarf living in Kemal Atatürk's house, or to say the presidency, was too much for them to bear. So they threatened, and Erdogan called their bluff, went for elections, and won a resounding victory. And from that point onwards, the military was defeated, contained. So Erdogan no longer needed to pursue a policy of democratization, etc., to endear himself to Europe, because now he didn't have to worry about the military. And then what else changed was, of course, he became more aggressive politically. In 2009, there was this event at Davos when he, in public, reprimanded Shimon Peres. Of course, going after Shimon Peres was not exactly the smart thing to do, at least in the West, because Shimon Peres is somebody who was revered. But in the Muslim world, that went very well. Suddenly, Turkey was catapulted because people appreciated the way he went after Shimon Peres. And then the Turkish-Israeli relationship also got worse. In 2010, you had the Mavi Marmara event, and Turkey becomes aggressively anti-Israel and kind of tries to take over the mantle for resistance to Israel, even though Turkey and Israel have good economic relations and have always had diplomatic relations. But Erdogan managed to play both continuing the economic relationship, but also politically being anti-Israeli. That's when Turkish foreign policy starts to change. But Erdogan also takes chances. I mean, he breaks with Obama over ISIS. He allows a lot of jihadists from around the world to traverse Turkey to go into Syria and Iraq to join ISIS. The problem, of course, is, looking at it from our perspective, is that at no point is Erdogan kind of reprimanded, told, you can't do this. There's an attempt always in NATO, American and European circles, to play down Erdogan's policies. And in a way, the more Erdogan becomes a bully, the more the West succumbs and doesn't stand up to him. And that encourages him. So if today's policies, when you see the Eastern Mediterranean or Libya or Syria, nobody managed to stop him. Nobody tells him not to do. And in fact, the problem, at least with respect to the United States, is Donald Trump, because he manages to create this relationship with Donald Trump that protects him. But to me, the most interesting decision of Erdogan is buying the S-400 missiles, which are Russian missiles that NATO and United States, the Pentagon, U.S. Congress, everybody kept telling him over and over and over, do not buy these missiles because they will clash with the F-35 program. The F-35 program was very important to Turkey. Not only was Turkey buying F-35s, but was actually part of a consortium that built the F-35. So Turkey was on the way to making billions and billions of dollars in exports benefiting from the F-35 program. Erdogan there takes a risk. Even though he's told that the repercussions of buying the F-400s would be terrible, he takes that risk. And I think there you see his overconfidence. He thinks that, yes, I'll buy the S-400s, I'll show how independent I am. It also solidifies his relationship with Putin. And eventually the Americans and Europeans are going to give in because that's what they have done all the time until now. And then I think he was surprised by the reaction because Turkey was kicked out of the F-35 program and Congress wants to impose sanctions. And the only reason there are no sanctions today is because Donald Trump has blocked them. So that's where Erdogan's overconfidence has gotten the better of him. And when you think about the relationship with the United States, the S-400 problem is going to be the one that is probably the most difficult to solve because there is no easy solution.
You wrote in your piece, Professor, that, and I want to quote you here, even if sanctions or other obstacles force Erdogan to compromise on one issue, the S-400, for instance, he will quickly open another front somewhere else. So my question is, if sanctions won't work overall, what tools are available then to the United States and the EU, for example, to check Erdogan?
Look, the sanctions I mentioned with respect to the S-400. So the question is, what else can be done? And on the Eastern Med, I mean, the Europeans have to take the lead because two European Union member countries are being challenged by Turkey. I think you have to go through a series of steps that increases the pressure on Turkey. And given how bad the economic situation is in Turkey, it's not just decline of the lira. It's also the fact that people are shying away from investing in Turkey. And Turkey needs foreign investment, needs foreign exchange coming from abroad to kind of balance its economy. And eventually, the pressure that will emanate from those factors may force Erdogan to change course. But Erdogan will always come back because populist leaders like Erdogan are always on the move. I mean, this is part of who they are. And that's why I said that, you know, even if he compromises someplace, he will probably open up another front or deepen another front. I mean, say, Eastern Med or Syria. So somewhere along the way, both the U.S. and the Europeans have to come up with a joint strategy of how to deal with Erdogan. It cannot be a haphazard policy. This needs to be thought through very carefully, precisely because Turkey is an important country. I mean, there's no question about it. The real estate value of Turkey, its location, its size, its both economically and militarily and geographically, makes Turkey a very critical country with which the West has to deal with. But until now, the de facto position has been, let the Turks be the Turks, you know, we'll manage, we'll figure out ways. But it's not working, really. And if something is not done, the consequences will be, I think, quite problematic because whether one likes it or not, Erdogan's nationalist rhetoric and push plays very, very well at home. Even the main opposition, except for the pro-Kurdish party, the other opposition parties, every time Erdogan does something internationally, they back him because he controls the press and they're afraid of challenging him. So the challenge will have to come from abroad.
Professor Barkey, thank you for joining us. It was great having you on and thanks for this analysis.
Thank you.
In other news, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo criticized Turkey's unilateral actions while describing Greece as a pillar of stability in the region in a letter to his Greek counterpart Nikos Dendias seen by Kathimerini. Secretary Pompeo stressed that Turkey's unilateral actions only served to raise tensions in the region. In the meantime, Athens has embarked on an ambitious diplomatic offensive aiming to woo new and old friends in a bid to advance its positions in the face of Turkey's provocations. As part of this diplomatic push, Greece is promoting new trilateral cooperation schemes in the region. Meanwhile, Meanwhile, Cyprus's government spokesperson said that Cypriot President Nikos Anastasiadis hopes the new Turkish Cypriot leader, Ersin Tatar, will show the necessary political will to create a more conducive climate for restarting reunification talks. Anastasiadis and Tatar are scheduled to meet on Tuesday. This will be the first meeting between Anastasiadis and Tatar, who was elected last month. All eyes are on the meeting, given Tatar's open opposition to a bizonal bicommunal federation, which is the solution already agreed and reaffirmed by the two communities several times. That wraps up today's Daily Roundup. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you.